I'm Zach. I am a musician, a former worship leader. I helped destroy a megachurch, and I'm not really sure what I believe anymore.
I'm Dave. I'm a movie buff, an occasional preacher, and believe it or not, I'm an evangelical. Still.
It hurts my heart.
Veterans of Culture Wars is the podcast where we talk all about evangelical Christianity, the beliefs, history, culture, and personal stories from evangelicalism. We welcome you whether you're a believer or not. And Zach, when this episode airs, we will officially be out of 2020.
We will.
Can you believe it?
We have 2 days left.
2021.
I think there's still a chance that 2020 figures out how to extend the life of itself.
Like, let us hope not.
I mean, it was already a leap year, but
right.
I wouldn't put it past 2020 to get another couple weeks in.
Oh man, we gotta have some hope somewhere, man. We gotta have some hope. So hopefully by the time people hear this, things are going a lot better. And also, so for this episode, we are gonna talk about fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, and identity. And Zach, as you recall, the pastor that we have in common in our past used to have a catchphrase with fundamentalism. Do you remember what it was?
It's something about they forgot to put the fun in fundamentalism or something.
Yeah. Or we're going to bring the fun back to fundamentalism.
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to bring the fun back to fundamentalism and talk a little bit about identity.
I don't know if that's, I don't know if it's, if yeah. We could bring some fun surrounding the topic of fundamentalism.
The topic, yes. Well, if there's any chance of us bringing fun back, it's with this podcast tonight. How about that?
Okay.
How about that? So to help us do that tonight, we have a special guest, and she is a public school educator, music teacher. She also is a former church planner here in the Seattle area with her husband, Brent. They moved out from the coast. You'll hear her story here in a second. And she is the author. She wrote her debut book, Tracing the Thread, Examining the Story of Self for Lasting Change. Christy Rood is here with us tonight. We're so excited. Hi, Christy.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. It's really good to see you again.
Yeah.
Good. Zach, it's nice to meet you.
Good to reconnect. And so to start off, we usually have our guests talk about their experiences with evangelical Christianity. And in the past, you've been a part of the more fundamentalist side. Do you want to share a little bit about your story with our audience and share with us tonight?
Sure. Yeah. I was a PK, pastor's kid, in a independent Baptist, fundamental Baptist church in Hartford, Connecticut. My dad was also the principal of my Christian school, and I was in a graduating class of 8. So it was very small. And we prided ourselves on our separatism, basically, we as weird as we could possibly be, you know, I had to wear culottes instead of any kind of shorts or pants to play sports. So that was a fun thing. And you know, just that was the whole shtick, was that we were going to be different and we're going to be unique and separate from the world. And really there was a lot of just fear-based teaching about how the world, it's like the boogeyman, you know, and if you take a toe dip in, then you're all of a sudden going to go all the way in. And so there was a lot of fear with that. And any worldly philosophies, you know, were shunned and all that stuff. And then I went to Bob Jones University, which was just an extension of my private Christian school. My parents went there and my in-laws went there. So in fact, my in-laws and my parents knew each other back in the day, the early 70s or late 60s when they were in school together. And then, yes. And then I met my husband, Brent, there. And so we kind of, reconnected. Our parents already knew each other, and so they were very happy to have us together. And Anyway,
so Bob Jones is in Connecticut?
No, it's in South Carolina.
Oh, okay. Okay.
We went to South Carolina for school, and my husband was from like Kansas and Pennsylvania, all over the place. So,
gotcha.
Then we met there.
Sorry. Yeah. For our listeners who may not know what Bob Jones is, I mean, it is pretty famous. I think a lot of people know what it is, but how would you just maybe in a nutshell describe Bob Jones University?
Well, I think it's changed a lot than, you know, today. I mean, I've heard it has anyway. But when I was there, it was pretty racist. I mean, that's kind of in a nutshell. They were kind of founded on segregation. And they were one of the last Christian schools to integrate. And so, you know, there was just tons of rules, and it was more than just rules. It was more than just like a West Point or some kind of strict military academy. It was really just that tying of spirituality to the rules. And it really was pretty spiritually abusive environment to be in, where you have to detox for sometimes years after you get out of that environment, because it's just so guilt-centered. But anyway, but the positives of the school, I guess I could say, are that they did have a pretty decent liberal arts education, and I got my degree in music ed, and then got my teaching certificate and started teaching in the public school in South Carolina. So, you know, it wasn't like a hokey backwoods type of, you know, environment. The founders really were into like the fine arts. And so they had like artist series where they had opera and really quality, you know, productions of like Shakespeare plays and that kind of thing. So I guess that was kind of a positive, but it's still, you know, the negatives definitely overweighed.
And yeah, there was probably definitely, I mean, it was all like probably classics, right? Like you mentioned Shakespeare. I mean, there wasn't maybe a lot modern. I'm imagining rock and roll is probably outlawed.
Well, so it's so funny because like I'm music ed. And so like when I go to take my teaching certificate exam, you know, there's questions on there about jazz, and I never had one class about jazz.
You have got to be kidding me.
No, because I wasn't allowed. I mean, it was all very classical, you know, that kind of thing.
Do you have any trick questions? Like if you get an answer about drums right, like you can't graduate.
Then you must be, yes, on the side.
Actually, I remember growing up, there was a guy that worked for my parents' music business that he went to Bob Jones. And I remember him telling me he was kicked out of Bob Jones for sitting next to a girl to comfort her after her father died.
Yeah. It's did he put his arm around her or something?
I think it was just like a bench on campus. Yeah. He took a seat next to her to, you know, she was obviously like going through it in a really intense moment. And just sort of a like, I'm here for you, I'm sorry sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that was too far. I am curious if, since we'll be talking more about identity, but when you were attending there, if there was a sense of identity among the students there that was in contrast to the somewhat nearby Liberty University, if you guys felt are this way and they are this way.
100%. Well, have you guys seen that Phil Vischer video about evangelicalism and fundamentalism, how, you know, the two were separate and then they kind of merged to create this voting block of evangelical? Anyway,
it's excellent.
So we were definitely in the fundamentalist camp, and Liberty was in the other camp, you know, when I was there.
So they were the liberals. Follow was the liberal.
Too much Liberty happening at Liberty University.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, we pretty much were that way about every other school, maybe about Pensacola. We were a little closer, but it was like, you know, Maranatha, Northland, Bob Jones, Pensacola. Those were the fundamental conservative schools that were allowed, you know, the rest of them. No.
And out of Bob Jones came the curriculum for many Christian schools.
Yep.
Pretty much them and Abeka were the... that probably still are. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But those were the big names. I know that's what I used growing up. And I've always wondered which one. I feel like it was probably Bob Jones, but I remember having a junior high science textbook that literally warned us about drums having satanic African rhythms inside them.
Yeah. Well, my dad was a music director at our church, and he had, those were the sermons that he taught actually were all about rock music. And he would have a stack of records in his closet that we were not really allowed to go access because they were for research.
Oh, no way.
They were. So like he would get them out, or, you know, he would use all these examples about backward masking and all the satanic influences. And if you listen to this, all you're going to want to do is take drugs and have sex. And he has changed, you know, drastically, by the way, just FYI, over the years with that. But yeah.
I remember watching in the 1990s, and maybe it was the 80s when it was produced, there was a documentary series called Hell's Bells.
Hell's Bells. It,
yeah. So you saw that, Zach?
Double make VHS. Rounds?
Maybe it was too, because, you know, they actually play the rock music and they were talking about the backmasking in Led Zeppelin's song.
Yeah, that was a big thing. Yep. There was also, there was a very popular, ironically popular website that started in the mid 90s that was just like, a list of every rock star who died early, just alphabetically, and it'd tell you everything. And then if you scroll all the way to the bottom, it was like, do you want this to happen to you? And you're like, and if you click yes, it's like, are you sure you're going to go to hell? And like, it keeps making you click through until it can convert you on the website.
Oh, that's so funny. Internet evangelism.
Oh yeah.
There you go. And on that list, I mean, the 27 is the magic number, they say, right? There's a lot of rock stars and famous people.
That happens a lot. But I remember the top of it said, for their rock is not as our rock.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That is so funny.
I don't remember which verse that is, but I don't think that's what the Bible was talking about.
Yeah, right. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Back around to Bob Jones. If you would like to share, what was it like dating your to be husband Brent at Bob Jones? Did you guys have chaperone dates, or how did that work out?
Courtships?
On campus, yeah, on campus you didn't have to have a chaperone, but you could only date in certain areas of campus. Like you could go to a ball game together, you could go to artist series together, or like Sunday church, that kind of thing, and you could go to the dating parlor, which no longer exists. But there, it was basically like a furniture store. You would walk up to the second floor of the student center, and it was just a huge room full of couches, and that's where you could date. And there were chaperones that would walk around to make sure that you weren't getting handsy or anything. So, but off campus, we had to get a chaperone if we were going to go on a date. And the best thing was that my sister graduated a year before I did, and then taught at the academy at the elementary school there. So she was considered a chaperone. So we would just go to her apartment and make out. So it was awesome.
It is scandalous.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm curious about the faculty there. Like I went to Seattle Pacific University, and my experience there was that the faculty were far less conservative and strict about their belief system than the students were. I remember the students voted down a proposal to allow dancing. And the faculty couldn't care less, but there was enough students that were like, I can't trust myself. Who knows where that would lead?
That's so funny.
Bob Jones, I always sort of assumed that's probably not the case there.
No, it's the exact opposite. Students were always pushing for more, leeway, and the faculty definitely, and really, like I said, it was this culture of fear. So from the top down, it was like, if the faculty didn't keep the students accountable, then their heads were on the line, and the students actually got in trouble if they did not rat each other out. If they found out that somebody broke a rule, if you knew about it, then you got the same punishment. So there's just all this fear, and I've heard that it's completely changed. I have actually a friend who's going to send their kid there, and he's kind of like sheepish about it. Like, I can't believe I'm going to send my kid there. But they have, drastically changed, and there's no demerits anymore and that kind of thing. So, I mean, I think that they have really kind of tried to, honestly, it's probably just for lack of students. I mean, I don't know that they could have survived if they didn't change.
Yeah, moving into the just conservative evangelical college, like that typical experience, rather than a farther right wing, which kind of is, a distinction with fundamentalism, because I think a lot of the media, and I don't think the media is wrong in this per se, but they will look at all evangelicals as being, fundamentalists to one degree or another. But I think there's different degrees of fundamentalism fundamentalism with Christianity. And I mean, the farthest I could imagine, Zach, is probably Westboro Baptist Church, right? And I imagine even Bob Jones would look at the Westboro Baptist Church like, those guys are just insane. Yeah, I mean, that the church that shows up and protests military funerals. And then there's kind of, you know, further down the line, there's Bob Jones in Pensacola, like you mentioned. And then there's just your average conservative evangelicals. And, you know, just for maybe the non-believers or, you know, the humanists, the atheists that might listen to the podcast, that fundamentalism basically, you know, I think in the 1920s, you had more like liberal scholarship with the quest for the historical Jesus. So there was just groups of Christians asking, okay, like, what do we believe, like, what are the fundamentals of the faith, so to speak? And so but I don't know, in modern times it seems to have taken like just a more extreme right-wing version. Do you find that, Christy, or how do you make those differences?
I think the main drive is a subculture. They just have created their own subculture that is a counterculture to and evangelicalism does that as well, but like fundamentalism had its own subculture that kind of maybe merged along with the religious right, you know, when all that stuff was happening. But it definitely started out theological, and then it definitely moved into the cultural. We had our own entertainment and our own, you know.
Yeah.
Instead, we did not listen to The Adventures in Odyssey. We had Patch the Pirate.
Why am I familiar with Patch the Pirate?
You don't know Patch the Pirate.
Uncle Charlie.
Uncle Charlie was another one from Grand Rapids, Michigan. So we had our own kind of our own entertainment that was even outside of neo-evangelicalism, which is what we called it at the time.
I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard our episode about Adventures in Odyssey, but my dad.
No, I didn't. I just heard it referenced in another one. But what were you going to say?
My dad wrote an episode of Adventures in Odyssey. He had gotten to know the producers of the show just through the Christian publishing world because of my parents' business, and always was an amateur writer. He introduced a character of the show named after me, who ended up being there for several more episodes and was voiced by one of the kids from that very popular show, Step by Step.
Oh my.
Yeah. He was like a white Urkel, essentially. I just remember, we talk all about it, but my dad refused the check because they changed so many things about it, and he didn't even know there were more episodes of the character.
Yeah. But so, Christy, post Bob Jones, what happened with you and Brent, and what journey did your life take after college?
Yeah, so we graduated. I graduated in 97. Yes, that's right. And we got married a semester before I graduated. So, and he graduated in 95. So as soon as we got married, we knew we wanted something different, but we didn't really know what. We were afraid, you know, to leave the camp because, you know, when you believe all your life that this is the right way, then, you know, even though you think there might be something else out there, you're afraid to really try anything else because it might lead you into the pit of despair, whatever. But we did. We tried out this church across town, and it was kind of like a hospital for wounded fundamentalists. And the pastor was just amazing, and he was very grace centered, and he was also Reformed. So that was our step into Reformed theology. Was this guy, and he introduced us to like RTS, which is where my husband went to seminary, and anyway, so that was our first little, you know, step away. And then, of course, moving across the country to Seattle was a big step away. And
that had to be a total culture shock, right?
It was. Yeah. I mean, we had no idea what we were getting into. We chose Seattle because it was so unchurched, but also because we loved it. We thought it was a really cool area and the culture. And I can't, like I said before, it's really hard to like go back and kind of put your head, wrap your head around where you were at the time and then your journey. And we're still on a journey. I mean, honestly, we're changing all the time. And so, you know, 5 years from now, I might look back and think, you know, whatever. But So yeah, we moved to Seattle in 2003 after we had our first two kids, and then started the church in Lynnwood in 2004. And we were part of the Acts 29 network. And we had heard about this guy, Mark Driscoll, and the Acts 29 network from a friend. And so we went to the boot camp, which was on a cruise ship. Actually, 9/11 happened on that cruise ship, on the boot camp, which was
a cruise ship, like Gulf of Mexico cruise ship or Alaska.
Yeah,
or...
yeah, wow. we were in the Caribbean. We went to Puerto Rico. Yeah. Anyway, I was morning sickness. I was like pregnant with my first and sick the whole time, and then 9/11. So it wasn't like the best experience for me. But that's how we met. Mark Driscoll was a really small group, like maybe 15 of us total. Darren Patrick was on our cruise as well. And so we really liked that, you know, that whole tagline of Mark Driscoll, which was theologically conservative, culturally liberal. We really liked that, you know, Mark seemed to have a pulse on the, you know, the heartbeat of Seattle and what they were all about. And we really loved the artistry that was coming out of Mars Hill, loved their music. We loved that they were really indigenous with their, you know, they, like you were saying in another podcast, like they brought music from the, you know, the musicians that were playing in gigs around the city to be their musicians. And we loved all of that. And so we came out and we asked Mark if we could just get up in front of church and recruit. And he said, okay. So I don't know if he's ever done that before or since, but he did it for us. And so we got up and said, hey, we're planning a church. And if anyone wants to join us, we're going to have our first meeting next week. And then we started in Bothell at the Lion's Den in Bothell.
Okay. I have to stop you there.
Yeah.
Before the Lion's Den was the Lion's Den.
Uh-huh.
It was Good News Music Service.
Really?
My parents' business, where I worked. They bought that building from my parents.
That's so cool.
My parents worked out a deal with them because they couldn't afford to get a mortgage on the whole thing. And so they I think they took over our loan in a phased in sort of way.
Wow.
My parents just really liked them and their vision for the space.
Cool.
There are crazy connections here.
Well, and their vision for the space was to use it as a church on Sundays and as a coffee shop all throughout the week. And so they had just opened when we found them, and they were like, God led you to us. And we're like, you know, we feel the same. And we loved our days there. I mean, it was small, you know, very small and intimate. And, you know, we grew out of there in about 2 years, I think, or maybe a year and a half, something like that. And then we went to the Country Village, which was a downgrade. It's probably not even there anymore.
They tore it down in the last year, which
yeah,
the real shame.
Yeah. So we were in the wedding hall.
I think it is. It's just... They had like a 30-foot tall painted wooden chicken out front. You know, it's just,
who can say that?
I don't think that any weird part of a city's culture should be removed.
Yeah. It was definitely weird. And it was a very good marker because we were like, turn at the chicken.
Yep.
Yeah. And then you'd hear them during church, the chickens, you know, during the service. So, you know, we lasted in Act 29 for maybe 8 years, I think, of our ministry. And then we were there for 15, maybe it was more like 10 years, but we could see the writing on the wall a few years before we left Act 29. And, you know, we just really struggled with the whole idolatry worship of Mark Driscoll at Mars Hill. And we actually, it was really weird fundamentalist vibes that we were getting from there, like, because our radars were super hypersensitive to that because that's what we grew up with, and we didn't want any part of that. And so, you know, when we would go, we went for 6 months before we planted the church, just to get a feel for the church. And so we went to community groups, and I went to women's Bible studies, and it was the strangest feeling because I was like, this does not feel right. There's something wrong here, but we can really put a finger on it. Yeah, we were too close to the mothership there with Mars Hill, with Acts 29. I mean, I think other Acts 29 churches are probably doing a good thing. We just felt like we couldn't be part of it anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think they've went through, I haven't really kept up with it, but they've probably went through some changes as an organization, obviously, yes. in, you know, yep. past 5-6 years or however long that has played out. But mm-hmm. how about this before, and this plays into the issue of identity, which we'll be talking about you and the book that you've written this past year, Tracing the Thread. But I'm curious, you know, from your time at Bob Jones until now, how has your view of God shifted? And I mean, I imagine that, you know, very rarely people so often think in binaries and they think like, oh, everything I was told is just a lie and now I'm different now. But mm-hmm. I imagine there's truths of what you, you know, grew up with and what you found at Bob Jones when you thought about God, but now maybe you're in a different place. And actually the beginning of your book is paradigm shift. So mm-hmm. you talk about how people change, adjust, and grow over time. And growth isn't necessarily just toward, you know, the Christian conception of holiness, but actually changing views and opinions mm-hmm. and being challenged with stuff. And so, yeah, how back in Bob Jones, how you viewed God then versus how you do now, what do you think has changed?
I think that, yeah, I mean, probably it's very simplistic and probably predictable, but I definitely viewed God as not as so much a loving father. You know, when I was at Bob Jones and grew up in that, it was more of a scary fall in line type of God. And I was just more fear driven in my relationship with him. And then now I definitely view him as I don't know. I view him as on my side. I guess I never really thought that he was for me. I always thought he was kind of against me or against my humanity. And now I think he actually embraces my humanity and loves every part of me, even the broken bits, you know? And I view sin differently, way differently. I don't view sin as an affront to a holy God as much as I view it as just part of my brokenness. And somebody said it this way once, like, we forget sometimes that Genesis 1 and 2 are in the Bible. We start at Genesis 3. Mm-hmm. We start with the fall. And we don't realize that God created us for glory, you know, and we are, yeah, we're a mess. We're a hot mess, but we are also a glorified, I mean, we're whatever that word is, we're created yeah. for glory. You know, we are we're a little lower than the angels, you know. It's like humanity, I don't know, I guess my view of humanity has changed maybe even more than my view of God, but it definitely ties in, you know.
So I imagine, because you and I both come out of that reformed background, and you were mentioning starting at Genesis 1 and 2, where in Calvinism, you know, total depravity is the, if you do the tulip acrostic, that's the the top. And, you know, you hear, you know, I mean, there's a lot of nuance, but there's a lot of messages of like, you're a worm, you're a wretch, you're just depraved. And
to quote Driscoll, God hates you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I sat under that teaching my whole life. So yes, I did really feel like God maybe didn't hate me, but I felt like I was not worthy of his love.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, and this point really comes across in your book, what you just said about Genesis 1 and 2, that people are, you know, image bearers of God. You see Imago Dei in your book, that God, you know, the creation was peaceful and God said it was good and he loved it, and everybody is God's child, and that all happens before you know, the fall. And then obviously in the New Testament, not going too far in the weeds, but the word for sin, harmatia, just means like missing the mark. It's like an archery term. It doesn't talk about someone being like wildly depraved to every ounce of their being. So that, you know, and that has a big impact on identity. Like you said, if somebody grew up hearing those messages and the shame and guilt that's attached to it, you know, what does that do to people? You know, I think we're seeing some of that out in the world, right?
Well, yeah, I definitely think that's, so every message could be boiled down, you know, every message sermon that I heard, you know, growing up and at Bob Jones. And even I would say, even in the beginning of our church, you know, Brent would agree that the messages really boiled down to you suck. Here's why. Jesus loves you and forgives you. And you have to ask for his forgiveness and repent and turn. So some of that's, you know, still true, you know, yes, yes, you know, Jesus loves you and, you know, you are a sinner, blah, blah, blah. But if that's all you hear, you know, you're just really going to have a very poor view of yourself and you're going to be hopeless. I mean, and you're also going to view God as tolerating you rather than actually loving you, you know, like he tolerates me. He kind of rolls his eyes and says, okay, I'll forgive you, but he doesn't see much good in me, you know? So I think, you know, it definitely does a number on your identity for sure.
Yeah. I remember hearing a lot of, you know, God accomplishes his will in the world, not because of you, but in spite of you.
Yeah.
And eventually you're just like, so like, why did he make us?
what's the
point? Like, I don't, yeah. Like, sounds like he should just check out.
Yeah. It's like that, I think it was Ignatius that said the glory of God is that a human fully alive, where that really spoke to me. It was like, humanity is the glory of God. Like he created us, in his image and we still have that, you know, in us. It's not gone. Just, it doesn't disappear after Genesis 3. It's still there.
I remember, and one of the ways of looking at this is only just kind of hitting me right now, but I remember being at a home group, a Bible study in the first couple of years at Mars Hill. And we were reading through Revelation because Mark was about to be going through it. And I was in this group with musicians that were writing songs in advance of the sermons. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we got to the part where it was describing what the city, what heaven was going to look like as the city. And it's like a cube. But then it says, and the glory of the nations will be like brought into its gates or something like that. And we had this talk of like, what is the glory of the nations? What does that mean? And somebody said, I mean, it seems to me like the created works, the art, the things that humans have managed to make that are beautiful, could be brought into there. And the idea of like God caring enough about something that we make, even though what he makes, you know, he's perfect and can make everything perfect, but would value something of ours enough to bring it in for eternity, was a really inspiring thought. And now that I think of that, I think that part of that reason why it'd be so inspiring is because the rest of the time we were hearing about how much he hates us and how we're incapable of creating anything.
It stands
good.
Out in stark contrast.
Everything that we ever make is tainted by our nature. Then how could it possibly be valued by him and get to be there? That's a verse that stuck with me a lot because of that discussion.
Yeah. You talk about this topic a little bit in your book, Identity as the Key, and I'm going to quote you here. I'm not sure when my paradigm shifted, but through experiences of walking with people in trials, trying to change my own attitudes and actions, and reading and studying, I began to understand over time that speaking about sin as an isolated event without delving into the motives and beliefs that drive these sinful actions was a mistake. I began to believe that changing foundational identity was a more effective method of change. I came to see that the answer had more to do with being than doing. If we could help people believe differently about themselves, they would begin to behave differently. And that's kind of, you know, a theme of your book, right? Trying to get at some of those root issues.
Yeah. I mean, I don't pretend to have all the answers, and I don't know that it's not like this magic formula, you know, but I just know it wasn't working. It wasn't working to just go through this cycle of repentance and forgiveness every single week. And it would leave people really hopeless because they would try, they would fail, they would ask for forgiveness. And then, you know, myself included, you know, I was in that camp too. So, you know, I think I found a measure of freedom when I was able to just be and just accept who God made me to be. And also when I was able to ditch some of those identity lies, you know, that I grew up with.
Yeah.
So,
because we so easily categorize people. We're like, oh, that person, that's the really bad sin.
Sure.
And this is the, yeah, I mean, understandable sin or whatever. And this, and we have all these compartments. So what you're saying, the doing rather than just being, and rather than just seeing like, this is a human being, this is a child of God, regardless of what they are, without putting shame or guilt on them.
Yeah. And that includes myself. Like there's a level of shame that you put on yourself that, you know, if you can kind of wipe away that shame, that layer of the, you know, I kind of see it as like a fog, you know, then you can really get to the real stuff and really start to work on stuff rather than be so hampered by, you know, I'm such an idiot, or I'm just such a sinner and I keep screwing up and blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, you hear that you're such a sinner, you've screwed up, that you just can't even get down to the why behind what's making you act or think a certain way. You just always feel so cruddy about yourself. Mm-hmm. It's counterproductive, is what I'm trying to say.
If we could get real basic here, what is identity? And I guess specifically, what is Christian identity? Like I would always hear, our identity is in Christ.
Yeah.
Like it's a monolithic thing. Like we could objectively say that if you are in Christ, then your identity is this way, whether that be you embody, like the, you have the fruits of the Spirit. I'm just wondering if there really is a way of defining that, especially because nowadays we talk about identity in terms of intersectionality a lot more,
right?
And
right,
our multiple
gender identity,
identities identity, and how they work together to form who we are.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's true. It's kind of taken on a different meaning over the last several years, but just, you know, identity in Christ. And that's one thing I really wanted to get into, because I was like, what does this even mean? And like, I was supposed to teach this for some women's retreat thing. And I was like, I don't even know how to get to approach this. Like, I believe that I should have my identity in Christ, but what does that mean? Like, what is that even tangibly? How do I hold on to this concept? And I really, it is hard to put into words, but I think, identity itself comes from the French, which is like identitum, which is like a mirror. So, you know, if you're mirroring, if you see yourself in the mirror, that's your identity. So you always are searching for that mirror all throughout your life. You know, where do I belong? Who do I most identify with, or what ideas and that kind of thing. And so for a Christian, putting God in that mirror is kind of the goal, right? It's like, when I look at myself the way God sees me, that's really who I truly am. That's my true identity. Like, all of my other identities are sort of secondary or even false, you know. I'm a wife, I'm a mom, I'm a teacher. All those are identities, but I'm saying they're secondary to my identity as, like, Henry Nouwen would say, the beloved of God. I love Henry Nouwen. He was one of the people that kind of really spoke to me a lot. And, kind of getting me started down this trail of identity, because he has a lot to say about that.
Yeah, he came up on an earlier podcast
with Stephanie Drury.
Yeah.
And on that, what you said about looking in the mirror and seeing God, I have another quote from your book here that I really liked. Quote, "When you begin believing the same things about yourself that God believes about you, you will come to a place of self-acceptance." Mm-hmm. I hear this basic statement from so many Christians. It's great to believe that God accepts you, but it's dangerous to believe that you should accept yourself. I used to think this way, but now it seems ludicrous to me. How can you say God accepts you and then go on to say it is unacceptable to accept yourself? The people who perpetually self-critique and self-flagellate are the ones who deep down don't believe they've been fully accepted and justified by Christ. They believe God is somehow displeased with them. And I can almost hear the butts shouting at me through the pages, but if I accept myself, won't I be accepting the bad as well as the good? But if I accept myself, am I not condoning the sin I know still lurks in my heart? But self-acceptance is really just giving up the fight, right? Self-acceptance is not tolerance of sinful behavior, nor is it giving up. Self-acceptance can and should be the freedom you need in order to work on your most stubborn, rough edges. If I see myself as perfectly right in God's eyes, I no longer fear him, essentially, is what you're saying, unquote. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that goes along with it. But, and I do think that's missing from a lot of Christian circles. Like, you know, the commandment is love your neighbor as you love yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, you should accept yourself, love yourself.
Driscoll went to great lengths to point out that that has nothing to do with accepting yourself.
Well, like, and that,
oh man.
Yes. That's the, like, you know, who is that guy, the Christian counselor guy, that Jay Adams, he was like, self-esteem is like the from the pits of hell. And basically you can't be a Christian and believe in self-esteem because you should be esteeming others better than yourself, you know, that passage. And that's a bunch of BS, because, you know, if God can look at you and love you, then why can't you look at yourself and love yourself? I mean, you have to love yourself. You have to come to a place of acceptance of yourself if you're ever going to progress, you know, and change.
Absolutely. You have to love others.
I think,
and you can't love others unless you are in a healthy place loving yourself.
Right.
You know,
you have to do that to love others. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, and that's a great thing about your book is, in a lot of, you know, biblical counseling that I've come across, it seems like it's kind of sin hunting when you go in with a problem, like, oh, you're depressed. Let's find out where this sin is and then like hammer you with it. But that's not helpful at all, nor is it healthy to get somebody to a good place, because some people are depressed because there's chemical imbalances or there's genetic stuff. And your book, you tackle all of that, the whole palette. You talk about the theology. It's important to be, you know, written by a committed Christian, and for committed Christians is what this book has. Although there is stuff that I think non-believers can get from it too. But to be healthy with God, the theology aspect, and then you talk about also anthropology. This is chapter 3, yourself, how you view yourself, how you view humanity, and then sociology, how you're going out from there, and how you treat other people. And it's a holistic approach rather than just a narrow, like, I'm going to find a sin and just beat you over the head with it. But let's talk about you as a person and everything that's going on in your life, and then be empathetic and compassionate with that.
Yeah. And I think that started with myself. I had to be empathetic and compassionate with myself and kind of uncover some of that, or deal with some of the past identity stuff from being raised in fundamentalism and as a pastor's kid and as a woman, as a girl, you know, which in a very, very masculine centered world, I dealt with that as well. And I, you know, part of it is like cutting yourself some slack. Like, this is why I'm reacting this way. A solid reason why this is my reaction. And then kind of uncovering that to the level where I could actually then examine the motives and then hopefully change my reactions in the future. But I think giving yourself grace is really a starting point.
I feel like there's a connection between understanding your identity and being able to love yourself. Because knowing who you are lets you like direct that love somewhere. I think so many people, and this gets into other stuff, but so many people the last few years, believers, have looked around at the dominant culture of evangelicalism in the Trumpian America, not recognized themselves in so much of that, and wondered what that means about their identity. Like, who are they if this is Christ to so many people? I saw you retweet a long thread from a Douglas Birch and saying you and your husband could have written this thread. You totally agree with that, and it's that sense of hopelessness looking at other this is just a few days before the election, mm-hmm. And saying, you know, seeing you can't comprehend the drift towards extremism, the change in the type of discernment that they have about these things, mm-hmm. and the sort of hopeless feeling of not knowing what this means for Christianity, for yourself. And so I was reading through that thread, knowing we were going to talk about identity, and thinking about it in terms of how you felt about your identity as an evangelical, as a Christian, as an American, as a woman.
So like, you know, the book I actually wrote it like a year before we quit the church. I don't know if you knew that, Dave, but so it's kind of in the past tense for me. It's not like it's not an important topic, but I feel like my current state as far as identity is concerned really is that I'm lost. I'm lost in regards to where I fit in the church, you know, and where I fit in, you know, Christianity.
That's what I'm saying at the beginning of the show
too. So it's like, it's even more of a struggle because finding like-minded Christians here is even harder than it is in Seattle or in the West. I mean, there's a grieving too. Like Stephanie was saying, there's a lot of grief involved in that. Like, I was in shock after the 2016 election. I really did not know. I couldn't have predicted that 81% or something of evangelicals would vote for Trump. And I think my first reaction was to go, okay, what am I missing? Like, what are the triggers that would cause someone to vote for this person? Like, what is it that they are like, is it economic strife, hardship? You know, is it really just like middle America is really struggling and we just have been blind to that because we live on the coasts and whatever. So I started to kind of just research or just maybe have some empathy. I was trying to like garner some empathy towards why someone would vote for him. But I've run out of that. Like, I still 4 years later, I'm like, how the hell could anybody support this person? Much less a professing Christian, you know? And I have family that support him. I hope they don't listen to this podcast, but, so that makes me feel even more lonely and isolated to, you know, it's hard to hold our tongues. We don't always hold our tongues in like, you know, family gatherings and, I think that if there were a good portion of evangelicals who held their nose and voted for Trump in 2016, a larger portion this time were much more enthusiastic about him.
After
4 years of the crap that he pulled, you know.
I mentioned Albert Mueller before on the show who says he did not vote for Trump in 2016, but did this time around, president of the Southern Baptist. And he, you know, he had this whole language in one of the episodes going back to that. But what's your diagnosis? I mean, this whole Christian nationalism thing, which the media mentions a lot, and I don't think they're wrong, but I think the evangelicals that I know, conservative evangelicals, they would probably never refer to themselves as a Christian nationalist, but kind of having the idea that I'm a Christian and now I need to have this influence in government. And these other people are going to move us in this, you know, what they think is a secular or godless direction, even though historically, I mean, this is all insane, but they believe that they're moving us in this direction. So we have to like elect these politicians who are just going to be aggressive about getting biblical values. I mean, is Christian nationalism, even if they won't say
they
just
that. Don't want to call it that. Right.
Right.
And right.
What's the diagnosis? Like, what do you, in your opinion, you know, in the identity issues there, like what do you think is causing the church to move toward that?
Well, I think it really has to do with like, it is identity, but it's tribal identity. It's like group identity is how you see yourself in the world. If I see myself as an exile in the world, then I won't try to, you know, get government to work in a Christian way, because it wasn't ever meant to be a Christian government. If you look at the early church, they were, you know, certainly not in the, you know, they had no power. They were under a dictator, and yet the church thrived. So, and that's what was, that is the kingdom. The kingdom is not an earthly overtaking of politics. So, but the other side is, you know, I view myself as a change agent for culture. You know, that's what they think. I'm a change agent. Like, we have to change culture. Their version of being salt and light is to take over the courts and the, you know, the Senate and the, you know, House. So it's different. It's a totally different way of viewing who you are as a Christian as it relates to your role in the world. And so, and I know because I used to think that way, right? So I used to, again, it's like hard to remember, but I did actually think that way at one point. This was the first election that I actually ever voted a Democrat. I've always, always voted Republican for pro-life reasons. I've always said, you know, abortion is the one issue I can't get over. I didn't vote for Trump in 2016, but I wrote somebody else in. And this time I voted for Biden, but I understand that thinking. I full on disagree with it. And it's caused so much damage to the church and to the witness of the church in the world and to our reputation. It's extremely sad.
The writer D.L. Mayfield has been writing more and more about Christian nationalism of late. She wrote a piece in late September for religionnews.com that went somewhat viral, I guess. It was titled "How a Sean Foyt Worship Service Convinced Me I'm No Longer an Evangelical." Mm. So she's in Portland. And she,
I know, I follow her. Yeah.
Yeah. She's mm-hmm. great. I'm going to see if she'll come on the show. She'd been attending Black Lives Matter protests in Portland for a while. Sean Foyt, the mm-hmm. Bethel worship leader, came through basically in the same space, essentially as a counter protest to Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
Holding one of his maskless super spreader COVID worship events. She wrote, "I knew almost every word of the songs the group was singing, but I could not bring myself to sing along. Surrounded on all sides by people with arms raised high, eyes closed, joy and certainty shining on the faces of the true believers, it hit me. We read the same Bible and we all call ourselves Christians, but we're not singing to the same God, and I could no longer pretend otherwise. I lost my religion that day in that crowd of worshipers. I lost the word evangelical as I realized I was surrounded by people who truly believed they were proclaiming the good news, yet on the edges of their concert, young people of color were begging for them to listen to their grief instead of shouting over it. I can no longer call myself an evangelical because what defines a white evangelical in the United States has become a longing for an authoritarian state where Christianity is prioritized and privileged." Yeah. So she's lamenting a loss of identity, among other things. We have labels like evangelical to help define ourselves for ourselves and for others. But then what happens when the definition changes such that we don't fit anymore? And a few weeks later, she sort of put into a tweet all those thoughts for me that I couldn't stop thinking about this. She wrote, "Maybe you're an ex-evangelical. Maybe you just really, really hate Christian nationalism."
Yeah.
And
yes,
to use the phrase of our era, I felt seen.
Because
I don't start the show saying I'm an ex-evangelical. That would be a new identity to put on myself, a new label that has its own certain things. I don't know what I believe, but so much of it is I don't want to be part of that. At all.
I just don't know what I do want quite yet.
When Dave and I talked about starting this thing, I was like, okay, so my stance is at this point, I think evangelicalism is a net negative for humanity. Mm. And it took a long time to get to that point, but I think that's true. And that mm-hmm. really sucks. So reading this, I'm like, yeah, maybe I still believe some of that or more than I realize I do because it's just in my core, but boy, do I hate Christian nationalism.
Yeah, it's really hard to distill like what are the things that I still believe and what is it that I am not sure about or know for sure I don't believe anymore because it's so intertwined. And like I read that same article that she wrote and it just I was like yes, every word. And it is comforting to know, you know, that other people are seeing the same thing and I'm not crazy, that I'm not the one that's, you know, going off the deep end. It really, they've changed, not me. I mean, of course I've changed in many ways, but I'm saying I believe the old version of them. That's what I believe. I believe that character matters, right?
See, that's been the question through all this though, is did they change? Or are they just revealing who they've been all along?
Well, I mean, in some ways they have, but yeah, you're probably right because power has always been central, right? That's been the thing.
Yeah,
but
that's the whole thing with
the. I believe what they used to say, which is that character matters and are
right. That's the whole thing with that thing saying, yeah, we no longer. Yeah, it doesn't matter. You can be a moral failure, and that won't affect your leadership. Yeah. So, yeah, did you ever really believe it was the other way, or just? Yeah. It was convenient to say that because you never had to have it challenged.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I have another excerpt from your great book here that I wanted to read and chat with you about. So this is on story and quote, "Your story has not always been easy. The reality is many of us have pages filled with heartbreak, abandonment, loss, abuse, betrayal, failure, poverty, and disappointment. Hopefully you've had chapters of joy, beauty, and love too, but there is no denying the experiences in your life have shaped your identity in deep and powerful ways. The rest of this book will help you flip back through the pages of your story to discover the foundational identity falsehoods that were sown when you were young. Then with the help of scripture and the power of the Holy Spirit, you will be able to uproot those lies and continue writing your narrative. This isn't some kind of revisionist therapy. You can't go back and rewrite your story or just pretend those bad things didn't happen to you. Those hurts leave permanent marks on your soul," unquote. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was great, kind of, you know, circling back around to accepting yourself, loving yourself, not rewriting your story, embracing your past with no shame and no guilt, mm-hmm. even though we may, like you said, we may have done bad things. We may have committed sins, but it still is your story. It still mm-hmm. is your unique story. And you can channel that and trace that back in the language of your book and then figure out, you know, where you want to go in the future, like where you want to go from here. And I thought that was a beautiful concept that you wrote.
Yeah. Like the story that was written for you impacts mm-hmm. the story that you're writing. And you had no control over the story that was written for you, you know, and the family that you were born into, the socioeconomic, you know, situation that you're in, the gender that you were born, the, you know, the race, the place that you grew up in, the church that you grew up in, you had no control over those things. And they had a profound impact on who you are and shaped who you are. So you can't just deny any of that. Like it didn't happen. You've got to figure out, you know,
do the work to move forward. Yeah.
Yes.
Have you happened to watch the new Pixar movie Soul?
Yes.
Have you seen it?
Just 2 days ago.
Okay. My 9-year-old's watched it at least 3 times that I know of. And it came out on Christmas. So 5 days.
I think, Dave, I don't know if you would agree, best Pixar film I think I've seen.
Oh,
I think it's a top tier.
It's up there. Yeah it's top tier. I agree.
I think Wally's their masterpiece, and I think this is the best one since Wally.
Okay.
But Ratatouille, Wally, I don't put The Incredibles as high as many people do. I think it's fine. Mm-hmm. I think it's really good, actually, but I don't see it as on the level with those. But I think Soul's right in the next, like, 3, 4, 5, one of those, it's right mm-hmm. in there. And I thought it was advancing ideas. It was playing with they were playing with an Inside Out and done in a more interesting
more
for
adult
me at least
way.
As an adult sort mm-hmm. of way. Mm-hmm. And so
same filmmaker, right? Same guy made Inside Out and Soul.
Not surprised.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah
he
must be a psychologist.
And he made Up as well, which I I have my issues with Up, but
the score though, the score.
I don't remember it. It's beautiful. Been so long since I've seen it. It's just one of those unnecessary villain stuff bugs me. That movie would be so much better without a villain. Much of Soul is dealing with, how much of our identity, our personality is something that's formed before we even are born. But it's beyond that whole, is it nature or nurture thing? Mm-hmm. I really like the idea that it plays with of too many times we think we have our identity figured out and we let it define us so strictly that we don't let ourselves move outside of that definition of our identity that we've come up with. So Joe is, I am a musician waiting for my shot, but I'm always going to be that. Mm-hmm. And without being able to bring in other aspects of my identity, I'm missing out on so many experiences and things about life that are here for me to enjoy that would inform that identity as a musician as well and make me a better musician.
Make me a better musician, right?
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was so moving and beautiful how they were showing that. It really is easy to feel like I remember feeling like when I was in my early 20s, when I was going to Mars Hill and I was like, okay, I've moved past that stage where my faith was my parents' faith. Mm-hmm. I went to a Christian school, but I didn't choose it because it was a Christian school. I wanted a small school in Seattle. Mm-hmm. But in those college years and the first couple after that, I moved beyond all the stuff I'd been taught. I was like, okay, this is my belief system. And then I was like, well, that's it then. I mean, I've got it. So now that it's mine and not my parents, then this is just what I believe for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And that's not how it works.
No, it's not supposed to work that way. You're always evolving. Right. No matter what shakeup you have to your faith, those things are they're inevitable, whether you have a major crisis like the Mars Hill blow up, or something else. Like, your life could go to pieces and in another way, and you would still struggle with that first faith that you had in your 20s and move on from that and evolve from that, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, in one sense,
it's not a bad thing. It's just, it is what it is.
It was comforting to be able to feel like I'd figured out my identity.
Sure, yeah. But how naive.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It is kind of an American thing, too, where when you're young, you're supposed to find out who you are. And I think we get the message that it's supposed to be fixed. Like, find out what you're going to do. Find out, find your thing. So in your 20s, it's easy to get into something and to say, oh, I am going to be doing this the rest of my life. Like, this is who I am.
Yeah. And then you feel like a failure if it doesn't work out. Or like, with my husband or with our trajectory, there were some feeling like, like we had failed. And then also because of our issues with God, there was some stuff there too. Like, is God disappointed in me that I didn't continue in my calling, as far as the ministry goes, because that's another added level of weird pressure to stay in something, but change is inevitable and change is good. So I think, going back to Soul, what I really loved about that movie was the focus on the mentorship and how when he started mentoring, he was changed by that.
Right.
By that experience. And I'm a teacher, so all of that spoke to my teacherness, I wanted them to go back, and maybe this would have been too cheesy, but I wanted them to go back and have him approach his teaching job in a different way.
I've seen various people say that, like, I guess Pixar probably felt like that was too predictable of a story choice, but definitely I could see that being like him understanding that, yeah, my identity is a musician, but my identity is also a teacher. And even though I'm not out there performing and touring all the time and living out that part of the identity that I see for myself, I can live out the teaching part of my identity and do it as well as I can. And
with new joy and with purpose, without feeling like it's a second rate. thing. You know, it's my, you know, those who can't teach type thing. It's my second choice.
Right.
But just from a teacher's perspective, that was what I was thinking. But yeah, it's a great, great reminder that you don't have to just be one thing. And in fact, that makes you a kind of a boring individual and a pretty unhappy person if you're so fixated on the one thing.
Yeah. Plus it's a movie about jazz and that was forbidden at Bob Jones. So, you know, it's got
my son's a jazz major.
Got the rebel
now,
aspect in there too.
Yeah. So you haven't told your family that you've watched Soul yet.
No. Yeah, they love jazz.
Sneaking it in when everybody goes to bed.
Yeah. No, my son is a jazz trumpet player. So that was, he's in college for jazz studies right now. So
my dad was a trumpeter.
Yeah.
Man. And well, before we let you go here, you've been so gracious with your time. I wanted to bring up a part of your book that actually terrified me in a good way. And speaking of, because it has to do with being a parent, speaking of your kid in school. And this is the section of the book. You have the negative you are's, as in the message, like you are fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. And you have the positive you are's. And you talk about how they both can be damaging. Mm-hmm. The negative you are's are self-explanatory. Like, you know, someone says you are an idiot or you are stupid. It's kind of those wounds that we carry around. Yeah. But then you go into the positive you are's, and this just scares me as a parent. You know, my kids are 6 and 4, and, you know, I'm reading your book and I'm sitting there thinking like, wait a minute. Okay. How am I talking to my kids? So that's why it kind of terrified me in a positive way. So let me just read this to you. Quote, "What about positive you are's? Can those sometimes have negative effects on identity? One of my friends said that being repeatedly told you are so beautiful caused her to attach her value to her looks. The phrase, you can be anything you want to be, made another friend feel like anything less than extraordinary was not good enough. In my life, being told I was talented and destined for great things had the same effect on me. What adults meant as positive reinforcement was heard through children's ears as pressure and expectation. At this point, you may be wondering if there is anything you can say to a child or friend that would not be harmful. There is. The right type of praise goes a long way to boost confidence and security. Carol Dweck's book, Mindset, asserts there are two basic mindsets that determine whether or not you will thrive. The fixed mindset is when you believe your qualities and successes are predetermined based on genetics. The growth mindset is when you believe success is directly linked to effort. And then you go into kind of describing both people have those mindsets, but it is kind of just scary to me that I can mean really well for my kids. And we all do as parents,
but then how
they hear those messages. That's what got me thinking.
Right. Some of it really is just not you, it's them, but in other ways it can be shaped by the messaging. Because if you compliment them, say, for their effort, you tried really hard, not you're so brilliant, that's different, right? So that's what that book is all about. It's like, you know, make sure you're praising them for the right thing, because otherwise they'll grow up thinking anything less than perfect is not good enough, you know? So I think that's what it is. It's just more of trying to praise them for their effort rather than.
Yeah. And you do come around by having a lot of grace, because we're obviously gonna, you know, again, we're not going back to a legalistic mindset where you can't ever say anything like that, but it does, you know, help us to stop and think of, you know, just what we're handing to our kids when they're so susceptible and the brains are still developing. And that's why he kind of scared me in a good way.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly something I think about with not knowing where I stand on faith issues, like instilling your faith, the faith that you have in your children, is in a sense giving them an identity and the theology that backs up that particular faith expression is defining that identity that you're giving them. And how do you do that in a way that doesn't feel like the definition is limited and that they're trapped within that, and like Joe, not able to see outside of the definition that they have.
Yeah, I mean, that especially as they get older, I think the key is just dialoguing. And I mean, again, I'm not perfect for by any shot, but, and my husband's a lot better at this than I am, but never shutting down a conversation, always keeping the conversation open. And so if your kid feels comfortable enough sharing a doubt with you, like, I don't know about this, or I don't know about that, rather than saying, this is how it is, this is the way, this is the way we've taught you, this is what the Bible says, always keeping that dialogue open and not ever shutting it down, I think is key. But yeah, I mean, I would say we would do our kids a disservice if we didn't pass our faith down to them, though. I mean, this is my core identity. I mean, I believe they will be happiest in life if they believe the way I believe. So I don't think that it's unloving to pass your faith on to your kids or restrictive in some way. But I think, you know, but we have to be open to the fact that it might look different for them than it did for us. And they're on their own journey.
Yeah. And I think it's helpful to remember that it's okay to answer with, I don't know.
Yes.
For some of those things. Or to couch theological questions as, you know, this is how I see it. Other people have seen it this way, this mm-hmm. way, you know, there's different interpretations and such.
Yes. Yeah.
You don't have the Calvinism acrostic tulip on your kid's wall, huh, Zach? Don't have the,
yeah.
Into a pillow.
Yeah, no.
L-I-P.
At dinner.
Hanging out there on the wall.
At bedtime, you know, I give him a hug and a kiss, and I say, remember, I love you, but God hates you. So God has issues. let's try to fix that tomorrow, okay? It's impossible. It's impossible, but, you know,
oh, man.
Do what you can. Here's your boulder. Push it up the hill.
Well, Christy, you've been so gracious with your time, and it's been so great talking to you and reconnecting with you. The book is Tracing the Thread, Examining the Story of Self for Lasting Change. People can find that on Amazon. Are there other places they can go to? Sometimes supporting Amazon is kind of...
The publisher is GCD Publishing, so if they want to go to that website, they can probably buy it from there too. So
excellent. We'll put a link to that in show notes. And I also want to say, you know, Christy is a committed Christian. This is a book written for committed Christians, but I do think for, you know, some of our listeners, and I know we do have them who may be humanists or atheists or agnostics, I think this book can speak to them as well, even if they disagree with the theology issues, but just for what I brought up at the end of the show, just with parenting advice and things about just the anthropology and sociology aspects. Christy doesn't just quote from the Bible. She talks, you know, she quotes psychologists and other experts in the field. I think it's just a really well done book, very well written. Yeah. So hope everyone will go out there and pick it up. And Christy, where can people find you on social media if you want to be followed around on social media?
I am not doing much posting. My life has taken a big turn to being pretty consumed with my teaching, but I am on Twitter. What's my handle? I think it's at... Do you have your thing right there? I think it's just Christy Rude, or maybe Christy J. Rude. It's one of those two. That's so
pretty
funny.
I wasn't. Have it.
Oh, well, hold on. Maybe it's
it
on
is
the.
At Christy Rude.
Yep. There you go. Okay.
Christy is Christy.
And then Rood.
There you go.
Yep.
At Christy Rude. Well, thank you so much for being a part of our podcast experiment here.
Yeah, this has been fun. And I loved listening to a bunch of episodes. I just sat and did my puzzle today and listened to some of your former episodes, and you guys are doing good things. I loved listening to your conversations.
Thank you. Well, Dave, thank you for introducing me to Christy. That was really nice. I really enjoyed talking to her.
She is a really cool person. Her and Brent, her husband, are both on my, you know, top tier people list. I like them a lot.
And for any listeners confused when we started talking about the movie Soul, you should watch Soul. I don't think we spoiled anything important.
Well, yeah, and this has been another episode of Veterans of Culture Wars. Thank you so much for listening to us. You can find us on Twitter. I'm at Dave J. Lester. Zach is at Muzach, M-U-Z-A-C-H. You can also hear Zach's music on muzach.bandcamp.com if you want to check out musically what he has done and is doing on that website. You can look at my occasional blogging at dangeroushope.wordpress.com. Music for this podcast is done by the one and only Zach, as well as the logo. Thank you so much for listening to us. Please subscribe, and if you're so inclined, give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts, as that helps people find the show. Thanks again. We'll be back in your feed soon.
Thanks for coming on down to the VCW. Remember, the podcast is free, but you still need to tithe 10%.